rather than me give a Dharma talk, if I may try to field these questions, because my mind is a bit foggy. Yes, my head feels like, I was trying to get the image. It feels like a watermelon with a mild case of poison ivy. Because it's like my gums are itchy. It's really, yes, and all the sinuses are itchy. Anyway, it's a good one, huh? So my apologies for not hanging out with you more, but I was hanging out with my watermelon. Would you talk a little about the mind sent outside? In particular, I'm curious about the word outside and its implied opposite of inside. So for me, it's that image of the wheel and the hub of the wheel. So the inside would be not so much. Inside has no, like, awareness doesn't really have any location, does it? I can't find a location for it, and I can't find a perimeter for it either. I can't find a center, and I can't find a boundary to it, right? And then the objects which come and go within the experience of awareness, those I can see they have qualities and they have life, right? And my attention can, I can pay attention to them. I can be, my attention can be drawn into them in ways of passion or aversion or a curiosity or analysis. So there's all kinds of activity that can take place with the various objects, and they themselves are objects, right? So I'm aware of my head, and then I'm trying to figure out a neat description of it. So those are all objects, and not very good for my samadhi if I'm doing that all the time. But then the awareness, which is kind of, you could say, is the inside. And this is the paradox, that awareness is born, both as Ajahn Sumedho says, it's the point that includes everything, right? So it includes everything, and yet it's also that which everything points to, everything being every sense experience. So awareness is both like present moment, and it contains everything and knows everything, that kind of idea. So the mind which is heedlessly always caught up with objects, that's for me the mind going outside. And then the awakening to that's just a changing object, making that illuminating the moment in that way, awakening to the moment in that way, you know, what language we want to use. That's to me not following the mind outside. It's knowing the mind as mind. And then within that, if you start to think, if you're contemplating this even more subtly, that's the kind of gross level. And I think at the subtle level, there's still a sense of me being the watcher, me being the doer, mana in the fetters construct, the I am. And even that begins to be known as an object. And this, so that's the more like Dzogchen things or more refined ways of the mind, looking at the mind or the who am I practices or even choiceless awareness, really. And the very sense of I am also is falls away. And that's what we call non-duality or emptiness. But it all begins with recognizing the importance of awareness and the limitation of objects, and objects being the five khandhas, and also realizing that in a world of objects we have to relate to them, we have to understand their emotions, and we need to, you know, feed the body's proper food and give it exercise and to, deal with our taxes and, you know, all the rest of that. So it's not dismissing the objective world, but seeing that the objective world has its limits, has its advantages and disadvantages. But is there what we would in modern parlance say, is there a spiritual dimension? And of course, the Buddha would say yes. So we're considering that dimension here, but not dismissing the other. Yeah. So that one of the ways they talk about, they say that all conditions point to the unconditioned, or all the things that are changing point to awareness. And that's the kind of marvel of this. If you pick up its subtlety all the time, like now for me, I was just noticing head sensations because they're so obvious, and I was just contemplating resistance. You know, what is resistance? Because that's more subtle than the head. Experience is very itchy and full of mucus and so on. So it tends to be something obviously I don't want. And then saying, okay, what is resistance, is getting me even more deeply aware, and it also tends to challenge the whole sense of I'm a guy that's got a head cold, that kind of self-identity, just by observing resistance. So that the attention is more deeply in awareness, and so I think the path is one of obvious to subtle, and sometimes they're just very obvious things we have to bear with, be aware of them, but sometimes, you know, the mind is more settled or whatever, and we can see subtleties of even the sense of I am the doer. And wherever we are in those range, it's all good. You know, it's all good practice. Do we participate in killing when we choose to eat flesh or killed animals? Well, in Buddhism, the killing would be like you have to have the intention to kill for it to be defined as killing. So in the West, you know, philosophers like Peter Singer don't like that because by eating meat we're participating in the meat industry and so on. But in the kind of Buddhist way of looking at things, it's what your mind is doing. So when you are actually killing an animal, you're killing an animal. But if you're eating a piece of meat, you're not killing the animal. So the deciding to be vegetarian then is an activity of compassion. So you choose to be vegetarian because you don't like the whole idea of killing animals and so on. So that's the intention there is compassion or renunciation. So there's different intentions going on. And certainly the argument about eating meat supports the meat industry is true. But you think about how the way we're looking at the mind is the mind, as it makes intentions, those intentions give results. So if I have the intention to not eat meat, it's not so much about not killing, it's about not following maybe my desires for meat, and also having a sense of compassion for animals, right? That's, to me, what's going on in the mind. And I think that's important in understanding how Buddhist principles work. So sometimes we might, you know, someone might prefer to eat meat, but you can tell them, yeah, but just don't kill. Another person, yeah, but that's killing and so on. But that person then can make an economic choice based on social justice issues or these kinds of things. So in fact, in culturally what happened in China, Vietnam, I don't know about Korea, I think there was already a kind of strong movement of vegetarianism among the religious, maybe the Taoists or whatever. So the Buddhists are vegetarian in Sino-Buddhist countries, but in Laos and Northeast Thailand and so on, the people were very much just for, like Ajahn Chah's villages, a a lot of their protein just came from the forest. We really would eat frogs and bugs. And I've had an ant larvae omelet. So it was an alms round, and I hadn't had any protein for a while. I just had carbohydrates, and I was living in this cave, and so I got this rice, and I got the Thais put the curries in a plastic bag, and I could see it looked like egg, and I was elated, because my body was really craving protein. Really, I used to have egg dreams, and so then I got back to where I was eating at the cave and got to dump this out. Oh, gee, there's ants in my omelet, and then I looked carefully. Oh my goodness, it's ant larvae. I said, okay, and you know what it tasted like? Omelet. It's really odd. So, but you could see my mindset wasn't that squeamish, actually, because it was really craving craving protein. So that's the cultural context of where I was kind of grown up. But what we did as a monastic community, then when we started the Wat Nanachat, which is the Western monastery near Ajahn Chah's monastery in northeast Thailand, we knew that if we didn't put some restrictions on, like we are not allowed to say to people what we want to eat. That's our way. We receive whatever food is offered to us. And you could argue, well, you have power, you have influence, you should promote vegetarianism, but that's not how our Vinaya works. We just accept what is offered. But we found at Wat Nanachat, we knew for sure that the villagers, even though we encouraged them to keep five precepts, they would eat meat. And so we knew for sure that they'd probably kill a few chickens for us every now and then. And just for us. Now, if an animal is killed just for us, just for our food, we cannot accept it. But if it's in the way that the person eats, then we accept a part of what a person has for a meal. So that's the principle that we try to live by. And so we made it a rule that no villagers could offer us meat. And we actually brought in cooks, because the villagers up there had no tradition of pulses and beans. They didn't have dal, not like India. So then we brought in cooks, and we taught the villagers things about brown rice and pulses and those kinds of good things. And then we said for sure if anyone from the village offers, it has to be this. They can't offer us meat. But if then someone came from the big town and they went to the market and they got something and it was meat, then we accepted that. So we kind of, and then each individual monk has his own, he can choose whether he wants to accept meat that's offered or not. So that's a particularly monastic take on it. So for lay people, you have to decide what you want to do. But the basic precept is not to kill. And then if you want to do the vegetarian, then that's wholesome too. That's wholesome. So they're all wholesome mind states. One is refraining from killing. One is developing compassion, developing renunciation. Could you please explain again the practice of saying this is how it feels? Right. I have been trying to practice, and I see that it can take us away from identification. I'm a grumpy person, to investigation. Well, so for me, just this sitting, there was the head cold, what did I call it? The itchy watermelon with poison ivy. Right. So that was, and there's tendency to moan about that. They get the violins out and So, but just this is the way it is. Becoming aware of, making conscious, knowing that knowing the experience before I conceive it, judge it, before I do anything about it, kind of. Or even if I judge it, then knowing the judging. I mean, wherever you take it. But so, okay, for as example, then I just make conscious. I just made conscious the front of my face. It feels this way. And then I noticed, then I noticed some resistance to it. Oh, and I said, oh, that's an interesting one to contemplate. And the more I did the resistance, the more the sense of me doing something fell away. So the identification then would be either, like each time I blew my nose, I'd look at the clock, and my first thought was, oh, gosh. So then I said, oh, this is a feeling like this is taking a long time. But as soon as I could do that, this is taking a long time, then I could see the resistance to the idea of a long time. And then the mind settled again. And then the itching would come up. And then so you keep coming back to the same attitude. And then people try to describe it in all kinds of ways. So then I use language like receptive awareness or watchful available or this is the way it is now or it's just this way or it feels this way. It's all pointing to the same thing. And so in the interviews, someone mentioned how like they'll just use a question. What is this? You know, and not to get an answer, but just that kind of brightening of the mind. What is this? And your mind goes silent. And again, I think like probably in Lompo's talk that you read yesterday, thank you. He'll say that the awareness is not, it's not, you can't really pin it down with a word. It only knows words. That's the difficulty with words. So any concrete qualities that we put around awareness, it can never be it. So it's always a receding from qualities to just know. That's why then the emphasis is on knowing change. This is changing, that kind of thing. So you just do, you know, I like to do it with very simple sense bases. So I just do it with my hands. I just feel the hands. And then I'll... And like I say, I'll change between body and sound, and I'll listen to sound, and I'll feel, and I get the sense of that. That's awareness. That's awareness through the two sense experiences, and then I just try to abide as that. And then if I want to put some kind of energy into that, if I feel I'm striving too much, I'll remember the heart, and I'll remember the heart as in a sense of perfection. That, oh, I'm home again. More of that. Oh, great. That's what I was like when I came here and I sat down. I said, oh, great, back again. Back home again. And the posture in that can do that. So we can develop attitudes like metta practice or whatever, or even just like more rigorous things like counting the breaths and so on. But it I think it's to return to the same... both like sati panya or sati sampajanya is both mindfulness and wisdom. There's an understanding, yeah, this is the way it is now, and that's enough. That is it, that, you know, I don't have to go to the next step. And that sense of renouncing the whole need to become is profound, because our sense of self is defined in time. I am someone who is not enlightened, or I'm inadequate and I need to do A, B, and C so that in the future I become more fulfilled or more enlightened. And that is what we call avicca, me as a person becoming another kind of a person. And that's quite insidious in all kinds of ways. So then I think we've all seen this many times in our life. It's actually very, very simple, but boy, it's hard to touch. We can get into all kinds of kind of complex trainings of this and that. And yet every now and then the morning dove awakens you or someone sneezes and, oh yeah, this is the way it is now. I use the heart because sometimes the effort can be too striving. I use the heart to make sure there's a kind of heart tone to it, a welcoming tone, a sense of completion. I find that very helpful. Kind of like almost a joy. Oh, good, this is it. As a counter to the desire to attain or get. Because that's very strong. You know, I'm kind of in the business. I'm supposed to get enlightened, right? So it's just so conditional. We've got to get something. Aha! If one is able to return and abide in awareness of awareness for periods of time, what is the next step? To take up permanent residence there or as much as possible? I kind of mentioned that, didn't I? So, yeah, it's a good question. The next step would imply somewhere to go, wouldn't it? And so to take up residence or as much as possible, I would say, yeah, that's what you're doing. You're becoming kind of familiar with where freedom is, how freedom is, and having confidence and trust in that. And whatever way one, that can be encouraged. And the doubting mind, like Ajahn Sumedho's talk, the doubting mind will, you know, say, is that it? There must be more. And if you believe that, then start searching. But, you know, you'll go to the same place as the, whatever answer you get, that falls away again. So, yeah, I think like words like trusting are good for me. Just trust in just this. Especially when it's boring, huh? Or when it's kind of gray. And then if you do something, if you choose to do something, like I need, let's say my mind is dull and I need to do something which has a lot of vitality in it, then do it for the sake of awareness rather than for the sake of attainment. So I can do pranayama. You know, I used to, as a younger monk, you know, like some kind of mad yogi trying to get his chakras ripping through his head or something like that. And it was all just striving and that. But I can do pranayama in a way. It's very vigorous, but the reference point is awareness of change. So there's a lot of vitality, but there's not a reference point is that I'm going to get something else by doing this. Then it's in line with this practice, and hence yoga or Tai Chi or Qigong. And if you're doing asana from a state of trying to achieve a posture, that's okay. You know, you stretch yourself and your teacher pushes you. But if it can also be just to do the posture for the sake of abiding as awareness. So the posture helps you ground yourself, but the awareness is always the refuge. A much more fun kind of way to do it, I think. But nowadays, I've heard there's hot yoga and all kinds of yogas now. In meditation, I often experience heat. What is this? Well, we talked about that in our group, but you never know specifically, right, what these things are. But we have an elemental body, and it has both vibration in it, call it prana, you know, different energies. We have heat, you know, we have a sense of solidity in it, we have liquids in it. So that's one way to look at it. The what we call the four elements, earth, water, fire, air, and that's just the nature of the body. Now, sometimes the heat can be related to purification, it's just related to how, you know, how much clothing I have. Sometimes it's related to hormonal things, you know, all kinds of ways that heat can be produced. So I'm not sure here, but the beauty of awareness, also something like very elemental like that, if you don't identify with it as a, like the need to know really why it's there, unless you're feeling, you know, it's physically, you're going to get sick or something like that, then it's actually quite a nice object to be aware of, because it's just a very obvious kind of thing. Oh, heat feels this way, as long as it's not harmful or whatever. Sometimes, like, we experience body as an energy body, don't we? Vibrational, that kind of thing. So the body, once we drop our conceptual relationship to the body, and we know it as a body, then we begin, you know, we see more and more it has these different ways of functioning. I don't think it was in that reading, but in the Theravada way of talking about our incarnation this time around, we have four elements: earth, water, fire, air, and they're called dhatu, and also we have consciousness and space. And consciousness and space are limitless, and earth, water, fire, air are limited. And Lompa Sameda is very good at pointing out that quite often in Theravada we've emphasized a lot the earth, water, fire, air. So, like, when, you know, we're paying attention to the body and the feelings and so on, but sometimes we haven't maybe paid enough attention to consciousness and space, and that's, he does that a lot. He refers to that a lot. So then, in like the previous question, there's the heat in the body, and there's the space which allows it to happen. There's the consciousness of the knowing, and the attachment to the four elements or the five khandhas tends to be a preoccupation with the objects, and the liberation is the non-grasping of objects, coming back into awareness. From the monk's disciplinary code of conduct, what are the things we, as yogis, can adopt? Well, less, not more. That's a good one, right? I mean, it's hard. It's a culture of that demands your attention a lot, and it's various media. But less, not more, is very much, and then less becomes more. But I think the four principles, I don't know if I talked about it earlier, of morality, satisampajanya, mindfulness, secure comprehension, renunciation, and contentment with little. Those are four kind of internal factors that we have as a basis for our practice. So renunciation is not shaving your head and living a celibate life necessarily, but it is knowing that in sense experience you cannot find you cannot find liberation or nibbana or the deathless, that basic understanding. So the five khandhas are okay, they are as they are, but you don't ask of them more than they can give, and so that sense it's not there. It's not in emotion, and it's not in sensuality. It's not in intellect. It's not there. So the renunciation then is, where is it? It's awareness. Which doesn't mean that one cannot enjoy, you know, a lovely trip next year down to Georgia rather than coming here for the cold. That sense experience is wrong. It's just limited. You just don't expect so much from it. You don't demand so much from it. So that's I think, really the basis of renunciation. And then you could see, you know, where celibacy makes sense in that, but celibacy can't work in relationships. Relationships are a different kind of relationship to sexuality, so that's different. That I can't talk about. I've lived a celibate life. But just the kind of less, not more simplification. And then contentment with little, obviously very helpful. And so our monastic standard is robes or clothing to take care of the body, food good enough, alms food good enough to just take the body through for the day, one meal a day or two as we have, lodging enough that it's safe and warm and so on, and medicine. Those are what we call the four requisites as monastics. And then we also have the Dharma as a requisite, and so we have our training and our teacher and so on. So that's the sort of basis of our material existence and our social existence. So I think for lay practitioners, Kalyanamitta is very important, that you have spiritual friends, that beings who have a strong practice of virtue, practice of discernment, practice of generosity, practice of renunciation, that there are beings around who reflect that back for you. They don't have to say much, but they reflect those values back, very helpful. As well as someone who you can vent with or cry on their shoulder or whatever. Those are important people too. But beings who are aspiring and who kind of set a high, who kind of, what is it, if they raise your game? Those are Kalyanamitta. And people to share the Dhamma with, this is very important, because you can be very isolated. Because although we Sangha, you say, is like the modern use of the word Sangha is that it's community, it's not really resident community. So we have a residential community which has its advantages and disadvantages. But in it, you're always getting reflections of Dharma. The robe is always there, teachers are there. So that's Kalyanamitta, very powerful, very, very helpful. Mentors to train. So how can you introduce constant reminders of your own aspiration? I guess you listen to Dhamma talks, or because like we have a reading every morning, or I give a Dhamma talk every morning, or you know, when we have a breakfast meeting, and there's a we have a, every week or every fortnight every fortnight we chant the Patimokkha, so we have images, we have Buddha images, we have a lot of iconography, we have the robes, so there's constantly Dharma reminders. What do you get? You get 40-foot advertisements of someone in their underwear. Really, what this culture does is weird. So somehow one needs to somehow get other kinds of reminders. So those are through people, through imagery, through art, through those kinds of things. But the rules themselves, the monastic rules, most of it only really makes sense in the context of like even like not eating after 12, or the weird things we do eat after 12. I mean, that's just us. So like if you want to develop some kind of discipline around food, then you just figure it out yourself, because even the 8 precepts say to not eat at inappropriate times. Well, there's nothing inappropriate eating at 3 p.m. It's just we just set it up according to monastic rules, whereas the monastic rule about not eating after midday came because of alms round. And the monks would, in the beginning, the monks were going an alms round any old time. They'd collect food, they'd bring it back to the kutta, they'd eat. And one day, so the story goes, a monk was walking through a village and it was pitch dark. And you imagine a monk, he's got his robe and he's got his bowl, and he approaches this woman who was washing her pots outside her house, and she totally freaked her out. You're a ghost! So she says, I think she went to the Buddha anyway. She said, it's better that you get your guts cut out by a knife than come here and scare me. So this got back to the Buddha. He says, okay, you can only go an alms round between first light, and you have to finish eating your food between first light and midday. so that we have that rule. And then you're inflicted with it during 8-day retreat. But it's got nothing to do with morality. You know, it's simply a social convention. And in Sri Lanka, you know, people love to do that as a part of their keeping the 8 precepts, so on. But you could keep the 8 precepts and devise a different kind of food thing. So if your family had, you could have, you know, breakfast with your family and dinner with your family, and that would be your appropriate times of eating, and then you wouldn't graze, snack, or nibble in between. You could do that if you wanted as a practice. Not necessary either, because that's just a kind of renunciant precept, simplification precept. But a lot of our rules only really make sense. I mean, there are a lot of very good rules about right speech, about sharing resources, about being able to accept admonishment, being able to give admonishment, respecting elders. So there's all kinds of really very, very skillful social rules in there, but it's pretty hard to apply it to lay life. But lay life has a lot of that in the workplace. There are a lot of things like that which are well developed, I think, in the public service and so on. I'm not sure. But the basic things would be around the 5 precepts and 8 precepts, around those. So the precept of not having entertainments and not beautifying and so on, they're just renunciant precepts. They're not moral precepts. So, you know, maybe if you're grieving, a piece of music might enhance the grieving and propel it up into consciousness, and it would be very good to listen to music. It would be a very skillful thing to listen to music, right? So it's by no means is it a judgment against music, but maybe just the kind of mind which always needs distraction, music is actually not good for you because you're always going out into the objects. So you could see, like, if you're grieving and you play, you know, you play a piece of music which stimulates the grieving, and then you practice, oh, grieving feels this way, it could be really, really skillful. But if you're always restless and you always need to put the radio on, you know, get to the internet or something like that, then that would be a different mindset. It would be going out to the objects. I hear if everyone practices the teachings, the planet will automatically be preserved. Please tell us more about this. Who did you hear that one from? Yeah, if my mother had wheels, she'd be a bus. Buddhism isn't a utopian teaching. You know, it has no kind of utopian ideal. And it says samsara is basically a realm of greed, hatred, and ignorance, right? And that it would be nice if everyone, you know, but that's just not the way it works. It's just not that. And it wasn't at the time of the Buddha, not now. But if you look at the world in a different way, so the world, that's the external world, but the world, the way the world, the Buddha defined the world, he said, well, the world is really the 5 khandhas as they arise and cease. So the annihilation of the world is not Armageddon, but it's just seeing that sense of a real world arising and ceasing and being the knowing. That's one of the ways we talk about the end of the world. And that's, of course, not... what's that phrase they have? The rising or...
Rapture.
The rapture, right? It's not that. It's just that awareness, like in when we chant, we say the Buddha is the knower of the worlds, loka vidu. Well, you might think that's because he has paranormal powers or something like that and so on, but it also, as a contemplative, it means you know the world as it arises and ceases as the khandhas, and you see the end of the world, and you see that in terms of very much sense of self. I am here becoming something, I need to go somewhere, and you watch it cease. No, it's the end of the world. So that's not utopian, that's transcendent, I guess, is the language we'd use. Utopias always lead to dystopias, I think. because they haven't worked yet. So there's no, in Buddhism, you have no, you have no perfection in that. There is no perfection in that. It's even like in Buddhist cosmology, even the heavenly realms are still transient. They're kind of, you know, you ride business class for a while, and then you start again kind of thing. So then you accept the fact that there is stupidity, there is injustice, there is ignorance, and you accept it, but you don't condone it. So you do your utmost to try to balance that in the world. You do your utmost for social justice or for whatever actions you can take in the world in whatever way, but you realize, yeah, but there is injustice, so that your mind also has peace. And compassion. So for me, the way I have in this lifetime tried to do social action is through building monasteries and teaching and so on. And that, you know, does a little bit. But more than that, it's not my karma. I can't lift it all up. There's a phrase in the text which says to not take up your own karma. The person who doesn't pick up their own karma is a fool, and the person who tries to pick up someone else's karma is a fool. And when that's, we all get caught in that one. Like with my mother, she had her pain. I could do as much as I could, but try to pick up and say, you know, I wish you don't have pain, but she does. You know, that equanimity. So, you get equanimity in the heart. And when people hear that, it's not what we're condoning injustice, but it's more like Lompo says, it all belongs. And then from that we say, okay. So like in the monastery where I have power, some authority, if someone is really, if I notice it and they're really abusive in some way or whatever, then I have to call it. It's my duty. Because that's the realm that I have power. I have authority if I see something wrong. It would be wrong of me not to do that. So that, but if I see something going on outside of the monastery where I have no power, I have to say, yeah, the world is this way. And it's not fatalistic, it's just doing what you can do. Otherwise, I think you'd burn out. Thank you for the questions, you saved my life. Please tell us about the expansion of your monastery. Can yogis now come and stay for a few days? How many monks and anagarikas are there at present? What advice will you give a person at the time of death? Oops, that's another one. Okay, let's do that. So, yes, the monastery is going well. We have we had four monks, two novices, or two anagarikas, and four laymen practicing for the winter retreat, which was really nice. We have a 3-month winter retreat where we invite a few people, usually 3 or 4, to join in the retreat, and then we pretty much don't take any outside invitations, and we try to develop a lot of formal practice. So that's one of the perks of being a monk, unless you don't like formal practice. So sometimes the monks like it. Mostly we really like that time, so it's a very quiet time. And then outside of that, we have room for guests. So I put some cards out by the books. Well, my apologies for putting out the books before the retreat. Someone said it might have been better after. Yeah, there you go. So we have room for guests, for men and women. Limited space. And if you want to stay, you just come and you join in the routine of the monastery. The routine is very simple. We have a morning meditation at 5. And usually that goes for about an hour and a half. Then we have a cleanup. We have breakfast together, breakfast meeting. We have a work period until 11. And it's whatever, construction work, gardening, office work, da-da-da-da. And 11 o'clock we have the main meal of the day. And then we help with the cleanup or help someone might be helping with the cooking also. And then that's usually finished by 12:30 or 1. And then the afternoon is free. And then sometimes we have a cup of tea together, sometimes we don't, but there's always tea and sweets and things available. And then we have a meeting at 7 o'clock, evening meeting. And we just, so if a person comes to the monastery, they join in that routine. So it's not like a self-retreat. You can't come and just do your own thing. But it's nice. It's nice, nice community if we're in good mood. better be careful. Usually we are. Yeah, we're pretty good. Yeah, and then you just join. It's nice, nice. And it's a nice piece of land. Very nice. We have 108 acres, a lot of water, so a lot of bugs. We've built a lot, done a lot of building work, and we're presently have engaged an architect, and we're trying to build quite a big monks' facility where we can. Right now, we only have one shower for everyone in the main house, so we're trying to build a good monks' library and abbot's office and monks' office and guest rooms and shower, toilet, you know, one of those kind of buildings. So it's a huge project for us, and that's going well. And yeah, so come. It's near Perth, and we have a booking form. Our monks are very efficient, and you go online and you put your booking form in, put a few dates in, then come and visit. It's nice. It's a nice. It is a kind of a retreat. It's a nice space, and we'd like to create more facility and all that, but it just takes a lot of work to build these things. So we are lacking in a large Dharma hall. We have a nice small Dharma, it's pretty small, but it all takes time. I think this is my fifth or sixth monastery. I was in beginning of Watnanachat, beginning of Chithurst, beginning of Harnam, Wellington, and now this one. So I have some kind of, and I still don't have my own shower. I graduated last year to my own towel rail. This, I have a towel rail. Ajahn Viradhamma. If you mess with my towel rail. So what advice will you give a person at the time of death when they're thinking of their towel rail? No, at the time of death, if he is in severe pain and cannot meditate. Well, I think the most important thing is that you know what your own mind is doing. That's, I think, the most important when someone's dying. That you are in touch with how you're reacting to that situation. And the more you can train in that, then the more possibility will be that you will be open to a response which comes in context rather than a pre-thought, preordained idea of what has to happen at death. I mean, watching my mom die was awful, horrible. And I'd been contemplating this for a while, obviously, and I think there was a kind of huge emphasis on the last mind moment. So I just read that Steve Jobs, his last words before he died, "Oh wow, oh wow, oh wow." You know, so you kind of think, ooh, that'd be nice. Have an oh wow. But you think about what's going on. The khandhas are breaking down and you don't know what's going to go on. So I don't know what the canonical take on this is, but I think really what's important is the momentum of the person's life. And if a person's really, really lived a good life and the last moments are like confused or painful, I don't see how that would negate all that good karma. I just don't see how that would work. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. You know, I do your best. But just try to be present in your own heart in a way of non-grasping and whatever process the person has to go through, they have to go through. So quite often, really, it's our own agony in watching someone go through this process. It's horrible to watch. So if you can, like what I didn't, I didn't have professional people there because my mom was adamant that she stay at home. And in those last, few days, I could have used more help, like got a palliative care nurse. But I didn't know she was in her last 4 days. It just went, it went so. At 96, you think, how come you didn't know? But, she just slid out real, real quick, and I was really tired. So that's nice if you have professional people who know pain management and how to do all of that in palliative care. That's great, because then if it's someone you really love, you can be more with the heart process rather than the physical process. That's very, very important. But you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what you can do. You don't know how you're going to die. So the more you practice now, the more you can be aware of your own fears and desires. And when things come up in family where you feel really frightened by the pain your own loved ones are experiencing, just see if you can be, this is fear feels this way. Come back to that. And that's the best preparation you can have. My first time I was invited in Wellington, I was in Wellington, and someone, I think they were dying, I think they're in Hastings or somewhere, and I was invited to go up. And it was a person I didn't know. They were, I think, from a Vietnamese background. Their practice was Pure Land. I didn't know their rituals. And I'm he's dying, and I'm called in as the kind of vicar of death or something, and I didn't know what to do. I was so nervous because I thought I had to do something. I'm the kind of priest last, whatever, and what am I going to do? And that prevented me from actually being with a person because of all these preconceived notions that I learned. So the more you can drop those preconceived ideas in that, and just then that's the best I think you can do. I was with one woman who was adamant that she wasn't going to take any painkillers. This is in the hospice in Wellington again. Beautiful hospice. New one. And she was in such pain. And I said, why don't you just take it? Just take the pain medication. And everyone did, and she took it. And it was she was much more mindful. It wasn't that she was stoned and delirious. She was much more mindful. And her death was a bit the better for it. So I think you want to be careful of not programming your mind as some kind of prejudice, both for the person dying and for yourself, if it's possible. Just as an aside to my mom's dying, I've told this to many people. I because it was in her home, in her bedroom and all that, and I was with her, I didn't let the morticians take her away. I kept her for 36 hours. Did I mention that in this retreat? Yeah, I didn't. I never know where I've mentioned these things. And that was obviously very powerful. So, I had seen people die, and I knew about the washing of the body and the setting of the jaw for rigor mortis. So I kind of knew that. So when my mom died, I invited the doctor, who was a Sri Lankan friend and family, and I did the chanting, and it was very powerful. And then they left, and then I just sat with mom, and I think I might have even fallen asleep on the floor right there. It didn't matter. And then I turned the heat down, and then I would do the when someone dies, you're very busy, actually, organizing the funeral. But my brother was great. He organized all that. And I was taking phone calls. And then I was very tired. I just crash out. And I get up and then just go in the room and sit there. I just sit there. It was very powerful, very silent, very, very peaceful. And then, before the body starts to decay, it's like you're sure the breath was there. Because your perceptions are so conditioned that the lungs are moving. Oh, and then I just look, and I just let the awareness. My mind didn't want to go to thought. Actually, it's nothing. It's just very, very peaceful. And then that's enough. And I'd go out, and I'd phone someone up and organize the funeral. Because I was, I was organizing the funeral. My brother was doing the funeral home stuff. Then I'd go back in, I'd sleep. So that was over the next, about 36 hours. But then by the next morning, enough already. That was enough. And then they came and took Mum's body away. And then we had the funeral. And then I escorted it to the crematorium the next day. They did some more chanting, looked at her body again. Very powerful. Okay, Mom. And then I pushed her into the oven. I pressed the button, did it all right to the end. And then she had asked me, way back, she had said, I'd asked her, what about your ashes? She said, can you take them out to the Atlantic? Maybe they'll float to Latvia. Which to me was so poignant. You know, that's the kind of refugees come. So then I went out with some two friends, and I took half her ashes, and we went out and did sea kayaking for 5 days off Nova Scotia. We started just off Pema Chodron's monastery. We didn't visit the monastery, but our starting place was the town there. And we went down that coast for 5 days. And on the second day, I took Mom's ashes and poured them in the ocean. And Adrian, who was the guide and Mom's physiotherapist, she had her dog's ashes. So I did my chanting, and I poured Mom's ashes into the ocean. It's very powerful. She had her dog's ashes. I did the chanting. And then Ken, his father had died 2 years ago, and he was very close to his dad. And he didn't have his ashes, but he heard what we were doing, so he brought his dad's shaving brush. And he took his dad's shaving brush, and he had it tied to a rock. So then I chanted for his dad, and he chucked the rock and the shaving brush into the ocean. And then we were all packed up. We had packed up all our gear, camping gear, and then we just started to head down the coast. And then there was a tribe of seals or colony or what's the word? Anyway, a group of seals, maybe 100, on the rocks. And as we came by, they all flopped into the water, and they started to kind of swim around us. And the young ones, I thought they were the kind of teenagers, right? They started to challenge us. So they'd come up and their dog-like heads, and then they'd dive in the water. It was fantastic. It was fantastic. Such, this nature, this and death. But then on the rocks, there was one seal who didn't come out, and we reckon it was dead. That was so powerful, right? There's my mom's ashes, there's death, there's, and there's this life, and then there's that one dead one. Very, very powerful. But what I found is just doing these things, it's very significant, because each time it brings up grief or whatever, yeah? And each time it's good because it's powerful. It's not intellectual. It's something, deep in your heart. So now I've got some ashes left. I'm going to take them to Latvia in June. I'll keep some and maybe put them in the meditation hall. So we can cover all the bases. But I think, sometimes our culture is too, we don't touch these things. Someone else does it, but I don't think that's all that good. I think the more we can be engaged with it, I think it's because it's really important. And you don't know what the importance is until you do it, do you? You kind of, you feel the importance as you do it. I know in Sri Lanka, I think they used to, I don't know now, they used to always bring the body back. The mortuary would kind of do the embalming, then bring it back into the home. In Thailand, we if a monk dies, we burn him. We had a monk who died very suddenly. He fell. Well, they found him dead in by his cave. He hadn't turned up for 12 hours, and they think he had a brain hemorrhage. What do you call that? An aneurysm. And they found him dead. And he was to come to Tisarana. And I was, I just talked to him about ticketing and has he got tickets and all that. And then I carried his ashes back to Tisarana. But in our tradition, then he had died, so they took his body to Wat Nanachat, and we have a burning pyre, open burning pyre. And there were about 100 monks in attendance. All the senior monks are there. We did the ritual chanting and then burned the body, and everyone uses that as a meditation. Well, yeah, that's very powerful. Have you ever seen it? Maybe the burning ghats? It's for many of the monks are very close to this monk, and he was a monk. And so the whole experience of dying isn't sort of prettified. And there's something it's very peaceful, because it challenges the passion side of our consciousness. That side which is passionately engaged with life. Then there's this, but there's this too, and it's a good peace. It's a really good peace, because it's profound in that sense. Our culture has kind of little of that, not much opportunity. Like, they could never burn me at Tisarana against the bylaw or something. Well, that was a lot, but it was obviously very powerful for me. But it finished, those things finish things off. That's what I found. Ajahn Sumedho's investigation of the word pure awareness, his reprise is his response. What about other emotions? Do they become purified? Okay, yeah, we talked about that. It's an interesting one. Is there a final point where you never feel any lust or any sexual desire or any aversion or any fear? I don't know. The texts allude to things, but I was just reading something called a beautiful book by Barry Lopez called Arctic Dreams. Ah, exquisite piece of writing. And he's a very compassionate writer, and he's a good field biologist too. And he writes about the flora and fauna there, but also he writes about the native people and their skills as hunters. And he has a kind of romantic viewpoint that they're all like really cool all the time. And he asks one of the And they are, actually, they're very strong people. But he asks one of the hunters, one of the traditional hunters, what do you believe in? He says, we don't believe, we fear. And you think, but you're hunting polar bears. You're on an ice floe. And then he describes some of the things, the drama of nature. He describes one thing where it's a phenomenon where a block of ice the size of several football fields just lifts out of the ocean and goes a kilometer and wipes out anything, and wipes out four people. Or a walrus comes up, sneaks up on an ice floe and just grabs a seal or a human. And so they or a polar bear comes up. And yet these people have so much intelligence and skill to live out there. And yet there's fear. And you could see, it's a primal fear that helps them to survive. They're always alert. He describes in this book, he gives a traditional hunter a pair of field glasses. And it takes the traditional hunter an hour to do 360 degrees. I mean, so attentive, right? Amazing, amazing consciousness. So in terms of that question, I certainly know that psychological fears certainly fall away. Self-consciousness and those kinds of things fall away. But maybe primal things don't. So I can only, I can only talk about my own fearful minds and lustful mind states and so on. So the lustful part of consciousness is very, very physical for me. And if that is somehow triggered, I know that if I don't pursue it with imagery, it just ceases, and it has no traction if I don't give it traction. And then psychological fears have no traction if I don't give them traction and aversion in that way. But are there primal things like fear and just like a mother fighting for her child or something like that, which are actually good and healthy? And I I don't know, like would an arahant, if he saw a polar bear, spread metta to the polar bear and the polar bear would walk away? Don't know. Maybe. Certainly you get a kind of hagiography of that. In India, you get hagiographies like that. You know, the great arahant did that, and I don't know. I don't think I'd chance it. But if the polar bear was there, and I was dumb enough to be there, and I had the presence of mind to practice metta, it would be a good get. You know, be a better way to dying than being afraid. I don't know the power of metta. Maybe it is so powerful that beings can feel that. Because you know, you hear about extraordinary beings whose mindset affects other things. So I wouldn't totally dismiss it, but there probably is a place. Like, so does an arahant have that? Would he experience that primal fear? I don't really know. But what we can know for sure, whatever the type of fear we have, we can be aware. And that is the real liberation. And if it doesn't cease, okay, that's just the way it is. So for me, psychological fears have ended a lot. I'm very happy for that. But if I'm asked to give a talk, maybe like a huge talk with 2,000 people, important, like 2,000 Buddhist teachers, maybe I'll just lose it. You know, 2,000 Buddhist teachers, what should I say? Or a Pali scholar, a group of Pali scholars, right? I'm just imagining where my fears might come up, right? But then that would be okay too. You know, yeah, fear feels this way. If I thought, oh no, I thought I got through the fear, God, there it is again, then that would be delusion. Beautiful book, if you have a chance. Oh, he's so good writer. History, Origin of the Chants. Our recent history, it would be these were chants that existed in Theravada Buddhism, probably originally from Sri Lanka, and not the English versions, the Pali versions. Theravada Buddhism was transported to Thailand from Sri Lanka. Buddhism almost died out in Sri Lanka and was re-transplanted back to Sri Lanka from Thailand and Burma. So the chanting originally probably comes from India. Then Sri Lanka preserved it. Then more recently in Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa in the 70s and 80s started to translate the chanting into Pali and Thai. And so that was quite revolutionary, not revolutionary, but quite innovative. And so people started, the whole country started to do this chanting in Pali and Thai, which was great, because then they understood more what was going chanted. And then we come from the Thai tradition, so we took that same idea, and then in Chithurst, the monks and nuns, I think Ajahn Chandasiri did a lot with that, and others, started to translate these chants into English. So we go all the way back to the Buddha, probably. And so we have chants, we have a lot of Pali chants which we've not translated, some which we have, and slowly the body of translated chanting which is translated and chanted rather than just in meaning, that's growing. So over the next 100 years we have a lot more. So it's a kind of, it's a nice to see how alive the tradition is. So that chant where we do the four Brahmaviharas, I think that was only maybe 10 years ago. And it's a very, very lovely one. Is it true that you cannot be taken on as a monastic if you are over 45? Who's 44 in here? Obviously, a 50-year-old didn't ask that. There is no age limit, so it's up to the monastery. There's no real limit. So the challenge of monastic life is that the social structures are very different than nuclear family life or or you know, being solo. There's a whole different socializing skills there. And sometimes when people are older, their social skills are set in other ways, and the adaptation is surprisingly difficult, right? So someone 45, I'm more like 60. I'm a bit nervous. I think I'm 66 maybe. Also, if we ordained a lot of people at, you know, just quite practically, if we ordained a lot of people at 65, then pretty soon we're going to be taking care of a lot of old monks. And we just, you know, physically couldn't do that because we have to take care of our own. So there's just a very pragmatic thing about, like in Thai culture, they will take on more elderly villagers who have served the monastery and so on. But then there's a whole, you know, 97% of Thailand is Buddhist. So they have much more resources. So we're always considering, well, how much can the, because this is all supported by the laity and us as monks working there, how much, you know, how much, quite practically, how much can we accommodate there? So there's kind of several factors. We cannot accept anyone who is not, like, healthy. Like, we can't take someone on who has HIV, or someone who is not full-bodied, so someone who is an amputee, we cannot take on. So there are a lot of rules there which were formed because of the kind of the responsibility of the Sangha and the laity to provide the requisites for someone. So if someone had HIV and they wanted to ordain, we wouldn't allow it because the whole community would have to provide the resources for caring for that. And that would be a burden which the laity... It wouldn't be fair for the laity or the monastics to take on. So basically, a monk has to be pretty, you know, fairly fit, a nun too, and be able to live the life. But if a monk contracts a contagious disease or loses a limb or something, then we're like full on. We're going to take care of them if they're old or so on. So there's kind of several issues there. Yeah, anyone who is 44, you better hurry up. I think that's it. Tomorrow is Saturday. And today's Friday. That's brilliant. Shall we close with a chant?